Morning, everybody. Welcome back. Let us learn. It is this Sunday morning's shir is sponsored by Le'il Nishmas Rav Yaakov ben Harav Shlomo Avigdor Rabinovitz. That is Shani Horowitz's father, whose yahrzeit is upcoming on Yud Gimel Iyar. Our limud should be Le'il Nishmasai, one of the shiris aplato, one of the people who came over from the European side and continue the legacy, legacy here in America, in East New York. From Shanghai, through the Far East, and re-established himself in New York. Our learning should be Lili Nishmosai to the entire Mishpacha, should be Amelius Yosha to all the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. This shir comes in the wake of the latest executive order. Now, I have to be careful because saying the latest executive order isn't always accurate, necessarily. But I'm hoping that since Thursday, nothing has changed. And the latest executive order, of course, was signed outside the White House in the beautiful, balmy weather by President Trump on an expansion of religious liberty for non-profit organizations. So let's just to appreciate the background to this. I'm not speaking on the legal side over here, but this is a very basic article that came out immediately on the day, NBC News, and describes how President Trump made good on a promise. So he is trying to fulfill all the promises he talked about, or at least some of the promises he talked about as candidate to Trump a little while back, and marking the National Day of Prayer. Signed an executive order, which taking a look at this, he called leading by an example, giving our churches their voice back. Now, what does that mean? Meaning, what is this executive order doing? What basically sounds like is that the president is giving more freedom of expression to religious leaders. Now, why is that important? Because if we reverse a number of years to 1954, this is in response to what's called the Johnson Amendment. Any person, any religious leader in a non-profit organization or any non-profit organization is well aware of the fact that there's something called the Johnson Amendment. Because if they weren't aware of it, it would not be so good for their organization. What is the Johnson Amendment? So Lyndon Johnson, the then Texas senator, when creating a number of the aspects of the IRS tax code pinned on an amendment which passed through the Senate, which strictly limited the ability of free religious or political expression from the pulpit. So here's an example of what it looks like in the IRS today. This is in the source 2, paragraph 3 of subsection C of section 501 of the Internal Revenue Code. Talks about corporations, any community trust fund or foundation organized and operated exclusively for religious purposes, has no part in the net earnings which inures to the benefit of, not sure what that means, of any private shareholder or individual. Why? And going down to the bolded section, which does not participate in or intervene in, including the publishing or distributing any of statements, any political campaign on behalf of, or in opposition to any candidate for public office, which means that should somebody who is representing a non-profit organization specifically back one candidate in the running in a certain political race, they threaten to lose the non-profit status of the institution that they are representing. Meaning the pulpit is not for whether it be a church, whether it be a mosque, whether it be a shul, whether it be even a regular non-profit organization. You don't have the right to use the soapbox of the institution to promote or to demote any particular person in a political race. And the penalties are severe. The penalties actually mean your non-profit status, which is a huge financial penalty on any organization. It is a movement in the direction of lessening the impact of the Johnson Amendment, which is still law. You're 100% right. This executive order is trying to, as what he once called, destroy the Johnson Amendment, and it's not so clear that he has succeeded in doing that practically, and I'm not so sure that anybody who had not been speaking about political candidates up till now will suddenly start speaking about political candidates until it's become very, very clear as to how safe they are in doing so. But nonetheless, irrespective of that, I think this is a moment to think back. By the way, if you take a look, this is very fascinating. This is actually on the second page. You can actually see the congressional record over here in the Senate in July 2nd, 1954, of the amendment, as was suggested over here. This is a record of the conversation of Mr. Johnson of Texas, and he is pinning on the amendment at the end of the tax code creation over here. This is actually the statement or the transcript of what happened over there. Very, very fascinating. And it is an important moment in history over here. This is a very significant step of what's going on over here that we're witnessing. This is a big change. I'm not going to say whether it's going to be in the benefit of President Trump or not to have done to have made this move or not. That time will tell. But one thing we do know is this is another step of infusing more religion or more religious principles into the law of the land. Obviously, this is a very complicated law, and we're not here to spend the time understanding it. Just to understand one of the possible ramifications of the law is that the reason why it was actually introduced is to differentiate, to make a divide between the tax exempt status of the church or the place of worship and political statements about candidates. Because should there not be that divide, some of the dangers are that now suddenly a organization can use its non-profit status to get donations which are tax exempt to proffer or to push certain candidacies, which means to say that it's a way of essentially furthering the buck on political statements, which is more complicated. Just one of the backlashes on this. Of course, this is more irrelevant when it comes to talking about mega churches with, you know, tens or hundreds, if not thousands, sometimes even over 10,000 worshippers, and the reach that this has. Obviously, there's a lot of complications, social complications, when it comes to how this law will, this amendment, and how this executive action applies to it. But nonetheless, let's return to the halachic side of things. So the question for us is the following: is essentially what we've been given, you know, the way it's been built to us, is we've given the churches and the synagogues and the mosques their voices back, right? They can now talk their mind. They're not limited by financial penalty to talk about what matters to them. And the question we have to ask ourselves at this point in time is, thank you, but is that what we asked for? Meaning, this is a moment in time where we can say, is it a religious obligation? Is it religiously permissible to have freedom of speech in this respect? How free is our speech supposed to be? We're being given now a much broader bandwidth of expression. Is that really what is allowed? Meaning to say, forget the legalities of it for a second. Let's look at the Torah perspective of it. Do we have freedom of religious speech in the first place? That's the question that's at hand. This is a very good moment to start on this discussion. So the question is the following. Let's start at the beginning. Before we get to public display or support or lack of support of a particular candidate or political statements, is one allowed to talk about other people? This is at the beginning. Let's just start at the very beginning as a basic. Are you allowed to speak about other people? So let's try, common wisdom would dictate that what is the line which divides what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say?
Based on their principles, so their political ideas.
Okay, great. Fantastic. So I want to reverse before principles, because that's really on the mark. I want to just reverse a little bit. What if you were to ask a regular fellow in the street and say, you come up to them, you know, mid-afternoon on a Monday afternoon and say, you know, what do you think is a right to say, what's not a right to say? What would the most common response be as to what I'm allowed to talk about or not talk about when it comes to other people?
Truth
or not, right? That's the most basic thing that people say. Is it true or is it not true? Right? Well, am I describing what really is or am I perverting what really is? And that's really what people will tell you. Happens to be in Torah, the Torah value system. That is not true, right? Because truth and not truth is not the dividing line of what I'm allowed to say about somebody else. Example being, there's many true things I'm not allowed to say about other people because it's negative about them. And in fact, there's certain non-truths which I'm allowed to say which will save other people's face, right? There's certain times where I'm allowed to lie, or a white lie, to protect the values or to protect other people now. So therefore, clearly truth and not truth is not the dividing line. That's the most common thing. That's the basic principle of every good journalist, if you think about it. Meaning, am I being as objective as possible or not? In the Torah system, that's not necessarily the starting point. Definitely not the starting point. So you might say, well, you know what the next step is? Maybe the dividing line is not true or not true. What's the next step, you might say?
hurtful and not hurtful.
Hurtful, not hurtful. Good or not good, right? More of a utilitarian kind of idea. You know, what would society bear, you know, if everybody was doing it? Or what would society not bear if everybody is not doing it? Is it the greater good for society to be everybody to talking negative? Or should I only stick to positive things? And you're getting a little closer then, but it's not 100% true either, because not all positive things are you allowed to say. There's what a halacha called avak loshon hara. You're not allowed to be over-complimentary to people, because you know what? Whenever you're over-complimentary to people in a crowd, you know what happens? There's somebody there who doesn't like them. You know, and what you're doing is essentially you're just lighting the fire. You're like, oh, so-and-so, he's so successful, so loved, so charismatic, and they're like, yeah, but he doesn't wear nice color suits. You know, somebody's going to say something, you know? So you can't be over-complimentary. On the other side as well, sometimes there are certain situations which warrant negative speech as well. Right, we're going to see in a few examples just in a moment. So good or not good, or hurtful, not hurtful, is not always an easier dividing line as well. Which means to say that it really comes back to values or principles. Which means, if you think about it as well, this particular law over here has a number of values in tension, a number of constitutional values. Freedom of expression, then the limits of discrimination. There's a number of values in tension legally, and the question is where do we put the pin on that spectrum legally? When it comes to us as well, the same things are in operation. Are we allowed to express ourselves about other people? Well, there's a number of values in tension, and the question is, where do we put the pin on that spectrum as to allowing that or not allowing that? So let's talk about some of those values for a second, okay? That's exactly your point was so well taken. Let's start at the beginning. So the first place we look for this, of course, is the works of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was a remarkable individual. Unfortunately, the printing was not clear. This is a picture that we have of the real picture of what he looks like. Just on the bottom of the second page, in the center, this is one of the Agudas Yisrael convention over 100 years ago, of the Chafetz Chaim, a very short man in stature and a great man in magnitude, in spiritual magnitude. You know, that most people are not aware of the fact that the Chafetz Chaim wrote, of course, the Chafetz Chaim, but he wrote also numerous other books. Most people are not aware of the fact that he also wrote the book called the Mishneh Berurah, which is the halachic treatise on the section of Shulchan Aruch, one quarter of Shulchan Aruch called Orach Chaim, which relates to davening and Shabbos and Yom Tov and Brachos and all the ritual practice in our lives, is codified. All of the, we'll call it 500 years worth of poskim, are summarized in the Mishneh Berurah and expanded upon in the Be'er Halacha and annotated and sourced in the Shaar HaTzion, which is a three-part work on the Shulchan Aruch. It is a staple for anybody who is going through the basics in Halacha. Now, it happens to be also has other many other Sfarim, many other Sfarim. But one of the lesser known ones is of a book called Likutei Halachos, which is his pirush on the Gemara in Zvachim. Right, the Chafetz Chaim was in fact a Kohen, and he believed and wished and aspired and willed to be part of the Messianic process, to serve in the Beis Hamikdash as a Kohen, and he believed it was our responsibility to talk about what's going to happen then, because what happens when Mashiach comes and none of the Kohen know what to do. Right, thank God today in the old city there's the yeshiva called Ateret Kohanim, where primarily it's Kohanim studying, and a lot of the halachas are the halachas of Zachim and Menachos. So that means Hashem, when Mashiach comes, we'll have a little bit of a conversational awareness of what to do when Mashiach comes, and Hashem, when the Beis Hamikdash comes, b'mehirav yomeinu. This is what the Chafetz Chaim, so they say, you know, they say about the Chafetz Chaim that he used to pray that people wouldn't recognize his greatness as a Talmud Chacham. He used to pray that people wouldn't recognize that he was such a foundational, consummate Torah scholar. And they say, look, it worked, because most people don't realize the Chafetz Chaim is the Mishneh Berurah, and they don't realize the Chafetz Chaim is the Likutei Halachos, these incredibly, incredibly broad Svarim. So they say, well, why didn't he pray that people wouldn't recognize that he was such a pious individual? Meaning, what do you think about the Chafetz Chaim? You think about piety. So why didn't he daven about that? So the answer they say about that is that he didn't think he was pious. So that's why he didn't pray about it. That's why. Nonetheless, the Chafetz Chaim is one of the most remarkable and leaders of the last generation. And his book on the Chafetz Chaim is actually a halachic work. There's two books. There's Shmiras HaLashon, which is a book in thought and why it's bad to speak Lashon Hara. And the Chafetz Chaim is actually the parameters of the halachas of Lashon Hara. For those who are interested, I just noticed that the new cycle is starting on Aleph Sivan. There's a three, you can finish the Chafetz Chaim and Shmiras HaLashon three times a year. It's starting in less than 3 weeks. For those who are interested, I think it would be a great idea. Saul has been encouraging me for a while to do a WhatsApp group of learning during the week. If anybody is interested, Maybe what, as Aleph Sivan approaches, I'd love to learn with those who are interested one section a day. It's really literally a page a day, essentially, of Chofetz Chaim. As we get there, as we get towards that in 3 weeks' time, anybody who's interested, please email, and those who are listening online as well, Rabbi Trump, or RABBITRUMP, not D Trump, at YILC.org. He hates it when he gets the email. So that's going to be a Metz Hashem. Even learning the halachas are an important, incredibly important part of our sensitivity, because to the degree we're learning the law is the degree we're going to be aware of the law. So let's start at the very beginning. What I want to do is the following: is let's take a few peeks into the halacha. So let's take a look at source 4. What I want to do is we know that the Chofetz Chaim lists in his introduction 31 and no less principles which are problematic. 31 principles which are a problem for a person engaging in Lashon Hara. It doesn't mean to say that every time you speak Lashon Hara, there are 31 transgressions, but there are potentially 31 transgressions a person could be transgressing. That's a lot, if you think about it. There's 613 mitzvos. 31 is a substantial amount of those just related to your speech. And he goes through this. There's a lot of principles against speaking. The question is are there any exceptions? Are there any things which allow us to speak about other people under extenuating circumstances? And the answer is yes. So we're going to go through two of those today. The first part of what we're doing today is to address the following question. Are there any values which are allow a person to speak about others publicly? That's the first question. The second question, which is perhaps even more significant, which we'll get to at the end, is should a public figure be talking about other people, even if it's allowed? That's the next question. So those are the two questions we're setting out to address today. Question number one. Are there extenuating circumstances, are there values which allow us to speak about others, which override those 31 principles that the Chofetz Chaim talks about in the beginning, that one is not allowed to speak about others? So here we go. The first one is the following, is the platform for rebuke. Can one use the public platform to rebuke others or not? The Torah tells us in Source 4, we just read this yesterday, don't hate your brother in your heart. Surely rebuke. I love it when you get a double. That's the way the only way we can put it in English is surely, definitely, rebuke your friend and don't bear a sin for him. This is a very complex pasuk. There's three parts to it, and each of the parts are actually related to one another. So it's complicated to actually unpack this. The Gemara tells us why the extent of this in Source 5, the Gemara in Erechin, Tezayin Obey says, how do we know if you see something that is less than savory in your neighbor that you have to rebuke them? So you have to rebuke a person even numerous times in order that they get the message. And then the Gemara puts the other parameter, which is should you do it to this to the degree that you embarrass them publicly, that the blood drains from their face? Don't do it and don't bear a sin on them. Meaning to say there's a bandwidth which is allowed. You have to make sure that they're going to change, but not to the degree that you're going to embarrass them to a point that their face is going to change. So the question is in that middle ground over there, is that allowed to be done publicly or not? That's the question over here. Are you allowed to do this publicly or not? So they're not so simple, right? The pasuk isn't clear about that. The pasuk doesn't describe that. The Gemara doesn't seem to be very clear about this. Are you allowed to rebuke publicly or not? You need to get other people to change. Are you allowed to do this? By the way, the end of the Gemara actually notes that that already at the times of the Gemara, we're talking 1,800 years ago at the earliest. We're told the Gemara is saying that there's nobody today who knows how to give rebuke anymore. And then the Gemara continues to say, there's nobody who knows how to receive rebuke anymore. It's a very, very difficult process. I'm sure that we've all been in the situation where you've mentioned something to somebody, and since then the relationship's never been the same. Because, ultimately speaking, we're all very sensitive. And when somebody tells you that something you did, it's almost like part of you is being under attack. And whether it's well-meaning or not, it's very hard to receive that. It's very hard to do it in a way which is genuine and appropriate. And the Gemara so goes so far as to say that whenever anybody tells you, John, you've got a little splinter between your eyes, the response to John is going to be, yeah, well, you've got a beam between your eyes, which means is that, that's all very nice, but in the end of the day, you've got more problems than I do, so why are you talking about me? And that, unfortunately, we today specifically, we become much more sensitive and less reflective to be able to appreciate anything which is coming our direction. So it's not an easy mitzvah to fulfill in any regard. The Rambam says that maybe there is room for public admonition. How do we see this? Take a look at this remarkable Rambam in source 6. The Rambam says on the left-hand side, this is in Hilchos Deos. Deos literally means perspectives or gateways in the Rambam's way of looking at it. This is where his halachas about midos, about one's characteristics are just defined in the Rambam, because everything is part of the Rambam's halachic system. So in Hilchos Deos he says, HaMochiach es chaveroi, when you speak to somebody, don't embarrass the person at the beginning. As we saw in the Gemara, should you do it to the degree that their face will change, you should not bear him a sin based on that person. A person should not embarrass another individual, and certainly not in public. Even though it's not actually punishable by lashes, which it's not considered an action, it's considered speech, which is not punishable by lashes. Nonetheless, it's a terrible sin. You do this to somebody publicly, you forfeit your own ticket into the world to come. That's pretty serious. Be very careful about public discrimination against others. However, don't call him a nickname that he doesn't like, and don't talk about things which he's embarrassed of. Now the Rambam adds on a critical condition. In which cases are we speaking? When it comes to a defect the other person is displaying, when it comes to how they relate to the rest of society. However, however, if a person is sinning when it comes to their relationship with God, and they've not returned and you've spoken to them about it, then you do have the right to talk about it publicly. Isn't that fascinating? The Rambam now has said there's a difference between, we'll call it ritual practice and social practice, essentially. That a person, when it comes to social practice, you're not allowed to divulge that to the public. But when it comes to anything that has to do with the way they keep Shabbos, the way they daven, all these other aspects of ritual practice, your bein adam lamakom, and we'll call it in our vertical relationship as opposed to a horizontal relationship, in such cases, you are allowed to use the public forum to rebuke them. Fascinating. Where did the Rambam get this from? Like, meaning, this is clearly not the Gemara over here. What is the logic behind this Rambam over here to differentiate between these two different, we'll call it sides, these two different parts of religious practice? Why should this be different? Okay, so therefore, you're describing. So therefore,
the one that affects society is the one that is the permitted one to lachiyah. Because other way around.
When it comes to ben adam lachaveroi, you're not allowed to do it publicly, says the Rambam. It's only when ben adam lamakom.
That affects society. That's individual.
So, when it comes to ben adam lamakom, this person is breaking Shabbos privately.
It's going between the individual when you're doing ben adam lahashem.
Okay, but that argument should hold true when it comes to Ben Adam Lachavera as well. Meaning, if you're worried about the slippery slope, the example, the not offsetting the we'll call it the bad growths in society, then that should be true about all actions which are negative, right? Meaning, I would say that even when it comes to the social forum.
Because it's personal.
Okay, no, but I'm saying like your logic is going to hold true in both.
One is a disgrace to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in public, and one is not.
You're saying it's more serious, but Markham is more of an affront to God. It's debatable, you know what I'm saying? Meaning, when I go and I deface another human being, right, Chas V'Shalom, and I go and I insult that person, there's also Ben Adam Lamakom there, technically speaking. You know, God says that person's important, and I think, God, well, thanks so much, but I'm going to sort them out because I feel that differently. So it's a little more complex, you know what I'm saying? So you're right, but at the same time, it's hard to differentiate.
There's an unintended consequence of a public attack on a Ben Adam Lachavero because the Chavero is...
Okay, interesting. So actually, interestingly enough, what Barry's pointing out of here is an interesting aspect. The Minchas Chinuch, when describing this, says the following. We're not going to read inside. The Minchas Chinuch says the following. Look. Maybe what the Rambam is trying to say is on a very simple level is the following. Is let's say over here that somebody insulted me, right? And now I need to know if I can now, I'm going to try to rebuke them. and I'm going to use the public soapbox as my forum. So why am I doing that? If it's about me, then it's not about him. Why am I getting on that soapbox? Because this is my moment. I can show him. I can put his nose in the mud and now show him what it means to insult me, right? So it's not really about altruism. It's not about thinking about him. It's about me. It's very dangerous when it comes to this. When it comes to Menon and Lamarcon, there's less personal vendetta there. There might be a little more altruism, which could be there. We're going to see in a second the conditions to it. But in the end of the day, says the Minchas Chinuch, and therefore, by the way, just what's the continuation of his logic, if I am not the person who is the recipient of insult, if I'm not involved in that riff, so maybe I should be able to publicly admonish such a person because it's no longer the, we'll call it the personal cycle. Fascinating, fascinating logic. The question is, does this play itself out in halacha? Actually, not so simple. Let's take a quick look. Few cases, basic cases the Chofetz Chaim lays out. The Chofetz Chaim, when describing these halachas, he has a number of chapters. In Hilchos Lashon Hara, in chapter 4, Klal Dalet, he talks of an Aron Lamakom. When you see somebody doing something, Rachmanim, someone should never see this, when you see somebody transgressing something which is between them and God. So you see somebody, Rachmanim, you know, they're eating on a fast day, they're breaking Shabbos, they're something which is Ben Adam Lamakom. What do you do in these circumstances? In Klal Yud, in chapter 10, he talks about Ben Adam Lachavera, which is the second section. So here's what he says. Let's take a few examples. First case, regular fellow, somebody you know, somebody you hang out with, you know that they're religious, they're, you know, we'll call it mainstream, good Jew, you know, practices, comes to Minyan, if they're a man, you see them at Shabbos, you hang out, you know this person's a good person, then you see them doing something which clearly looks like to you that they must have, you know, like it's like, you know, they're doing something on Shabbos, let's say, and you know that it's not intentional. You clearly, you know, there's something a little off perhaps in their judgment, or maybe they're making a mistake. What do you do in that circumstance? That's case number one. What do you do about such a person? Your neighbor is doing something on Shabbos in an incorrect fashion, right? But you know that they're a good person. They know that they want to keep Torah, but in this particular case, they're not. So what do you do in such a circumstance?
They're watering the lawn.
Yeah. Right, so the lawn's being watered on Shabbos. You know that they're good people. You know that they're not people who are flagrantly, you know, going to try to publicly do this kind of thing. So what do you do in such a circumstance? What's the reaction? That's a private discussion. That's what the Chofetz Chaim says. He says in source 8, we're now in the first paragraph in case 1. He says, I just highlighted the areas. I'm leaving a little bit of text over here just because it's worthwhile actually going through the case by case basis over here oneself with as a translation as well. I want to just focus in on his response. He says, "Bavadai yesh lislois bozer." You definitely can assume that there's something not, meaning it's not intentional over here. So you can't even tell it to anybody else. You can't say, you know, I was just walking past someone's house and I noticed that the sprinklers were on. You can't talk about that to other people. So people shouldn't think of them in an untoward fashion. You can't even yourself judge them unfavorably. You leave it as you don't even need to discuss it with them. But the point is that you yourself can't lay judgment. The second case is a little more complex. The complex is over here, is what happens now in case number 2, where a person you see now is doing something a little more unexcusable. Right? So whatever they're doing, the way he describes it is, he gives examples where a person unfortunately has an illicit relationship with somebody. The person's eating things which are clearly not kosher. We're not talking about over here whether it has an OU or not. We're talking about where it's clearly a person knows it's treif and they're eating in such an institution. What do you do? And everybody knows about this. So he says, so the Chofetz Chaim says, what do you do in such a case? So you can't over here now say, well, you know, it was an occasional, it must have been a mistake, and we'll leave it on the wayside and we'll forget about it and let bygones be bygones and everything's fine. He says, Tolu Bozeh. He says this is on the fourth line in case 2. If we're talking about an individual who really is a pious individual, he generally tries to avoid his sin. So, and you only notice one time that this occurred. He says you leave it, you don't mention it to anybody else because you can assume that he did tshuva on this himself. In this case, you go over to the individual and you say, you know, I couldn't help but notice, and it pains me to see. And I know that I maybe misunderstood or I only saw half the story, but I did see this. I was passing by McDonald's on the Sunrise Highway, and I did happen to notice that there you were with the, you know, the Mackey D, you know, right by your, I don't know what to think. I saw you on the poster. I don't know what else to see. I'll share him reis alo kol bechetov ishiyir alik doris atzmim mikan ve'elach me'asibos shevyu lozeh kadei shlo yavoy od lidei chet. So you're not allowed to reveal it, but you deal with it on a one-to-one basis and you try to discuss it. Because over here there's less reason to say there was occasional mistake. Case number three gets a little more complicated. What happens if we're not talking about an individual who's generally a good kind of a Jew? A guy who, the way that the Chofetz Chaim describes, is an evil. You know, a person who's like, you know, generally a, you know, kind of a scoffer. You know, he doesn't take life too seriously, he doesn't take Judaism too seriously either. But in general, he doesn't take life too seriously. And you see the person is doing something. The problem is that in many cases, you know, with this kind of person, you tell them, they'll laugh at your face, right? Meaning, they're not interested in hearing what you have to say. So what do you do in this case? So he says the following, the Chofetz Chaim says in this case. Take a look at the embolded section first. He says, Alkein tov lohem she'agidu l'dayane ha'ir k'dei she'hein yi'asru al avonev yafrishu me'israel al-ahaba. Certain cases, now this is in a case where there was more of a central control in Judaism, you go to the dayanim of the city, and you say to them, you as responsible spiritual leaders of the city, you need to speak to this individual. Look what we see him doing, because he's not going to listen to me. He's going to say to me, what I care for your opinion. So you speak to the dayanim. V'nira duhu me'adin l'krovov, du'adin l'krovov shalachoyte im tivreihim yimiskablim noi. Or you maybe can even tell it to their relatives, if they themselves may have influence on them. Because you realize that you don't have leverage, you're not going to be able to have any impact, because the person is interested in hearing what you've got to say. So maybe you can speak to the dayan of the town. The Chofetz Chaim adds a little bit of an asterisk over here, and he says, that's only if you saw it with somebody else. Because if you're an individual who sees it, you don't have the right to come in front of Beis Din to describe what you saw, because there's a prohibition of an Eid Echad coming in front of a single witness, coming in front of Beis Din. They don't have the right to listen to you if you're only one witness who saw this. And therefore you can't tell them. So the only thing you may be able to do is to tell your spiritual leader, so that he himself can individually distance people from such a person, but not on a public level. That's level number three. Okay, so if this goes on. And unfortunately, the fourth and most severe case that Chofetz Chaim describes over here is what happens when you're talking about a person who's not just a scoffer, but a person who's a wanton, you know, flagrant, you know, person who disregards the Torah system, or any system, you know, and the Torah system is part of that as well. What about such a person? So it's not that he's not going to listen to you. He's not going to listen to anybody. You know what I'm saying? The Dayanim will speak to him. That doesn't make a difference to him. Somebody, a rabbi will take him aside quietly and kindly. It's not going to make a difference to him. He doesn't care. He's the kind of person who is, that's it, this is what I'm doing. Speak to the hand. So what do you say to such a person? So the Chofetz Chaim says, such an individual, if you're aware of the fact that they're not going to listen to you or anybody else, you can talk about them publicly, whether in front of them or not in front of them, you're able to publicize what they did. As a why, what's the logic behind it? Is because this may allow them, if now there's going to be a public display or discussion about that person around the Shabbos table, that's going to be a reason that the person may come around to change their behavior cycle based on what you set into motion. So these are the four tiers of the Chofetz Chaim. However, don't think it's so simple, because the Chofetz Chaim adds at the end of the paragraph. Three lines from the bottom on the page six. Ach yesh li yizoy shelo lishkach protim achadim ha-mitzarchim lozeh. V'kosavtim ha-berchum ha-im chayim. There are a few conditions. You can't do this just anytime you want. There are a few prerequisites for this. You're going to see those prerequisites in a second as to when you're allowed to do this. So what we see over here, just as an interesting, just to sort of step back, is over here, the Chofetz Chaim says, when it comes to seeing a person transgressing in a, and we'll call it a sin bin adam lamakom, are you allowed to get involved? The answer is, well, it depends. It depends how wanton it is. When you can ascertain that this person is completely doing this wantonly and intentionally, without intention or hope to change, that's when you're allowed to do this under certain conditions. The Chofetz Chaim says, interestingly enough, where does he mention the conditions? He mentions them later when it comes to Ben Adam Lechaveroi. When it comes to in Klal Yud, when it talks about what happens when it's now affecting other people. So take a look at this. Source 9. I described beforehand what we just talked about when you see a problem that's going on between a person and the Creator. He says, I put this in its own section. He says, what's happening? Here's the situation. So you are the witness. You are purview to that somebody does something terrible to their friend. You see that somebody else has perverted justice. They've stolen from them. They have caused them financial damage or hurt them. Whether the victim is aware of what has happened to them or not, or he was embarrassed by this predator, or hurt, or treated. And you know that there are no reparations were made in this particular circumstance, and you're very well aware of that. In such a case, you're allowed to talk about this what you witnessed, so that it may bring about correction or reparations to the situation, because now it becomes a public issue. And here is details. Here are the conditions. So let's take a look at his conditions. Not so simple, by the way. Number one, you need to be privy to it yourself. It can't be hearsay. Yenem told me that his neighbor's dog's cousin once happened to be walking past and heard that somebody might have done something. That's not sufficient grounds for this. You need to actually have some sort of skin in the game in the sense of actually seeing it. Number two, she is oima ochele yachlit techeves ainyan bedatele gozel eshako alahazek kayasabaze. Rakis bonin hateves etzomainan. You need to have really thought about it. You need to make sure that what you saw is what you saw, not what you imagined you saw. Number three. You should approach the individual and say, you know, I noticed that you just defrauded your friend. I noticed that you just drove into his fence. I noticed that you did such and such. And speak to him. Number four, you don't turn him into a demon. You describe when you're describing publicly what happened. You describe exactly what happened. You don't go overboard. This one is the hardest of all of them. The point of what you're doing in public is for the benefit of who? For the benefit of who?
Him.
The victim and the perpetrator, right? That he's going to now fix things, and that the victim is going to have reparations. Think about that. That you're not thinking about the fact that you're going to be now the medium of the justice and the knight in shining armor, that the community is going to see that you take a stand. That's not allowed. If there's another way you can do this, then do it the other way. Don't do it this way. This is a last resort. And finally, number seven, you shouldn't cause unnecessary damage. Again, that's a little bit of a grayscale over here. But nonetheless, the Chofetz Chaim says, should you get to such a point, and you fulfill these seven steps over here, then yes, absolutely, you're allowed to use the public forum to describe this. One second, if it's all right, just for the sake of time, so there's a lot of details still awaiting. So the Chofetz Chaim says over here, you're allowed to go to the public. Let me ask you a question. Has the Chofetz Chaim differentiated between sins which a person sees, which are called Beit Adam Lamakom, or Bein Adam Lechaveroi? Is there a difference in these two areas of halacha? Can you go public in either case, according to Chofetz Chaim?
Yeah.
You can go public in both cases based on these conditions. What's the difference when it comes to Bein Adam Lamakom, interestingly enough? No, that was in the case of reporting to the Dayanim.
The difference, obviously, is the narcissistic intention.
Well, he would require...
That is true.
It happens to be, though, that the Makaven HaToeles is in both cases. He applies the conditions to both sets. So there's still an element of altruism, which he's hoping to gain in both. It seems like then, when you see a person, let's say, breaking Shabbos, in such a case, you just need to be absolutely sure. I mean, so the degree of how sure and what kind of person he is needs four cases to get to that point where you know. Whereas when it comes to Ben Adam Lechavero, it seems a little more when, you know, as long as you're pretty clear, you've had a conversation with him and nothing's happening, that's it. So it seems like you need to go to a further level, interestingly, moving away from the distinction of the Rambam itself. This is where the Chofetz Chaim describes it. So you may say to yourself over here, well, maybe one area where a person may use a public sphere to talk about another individual is when it comes to rebuking that individual for something that they've done, and it's going to help them and it's going to help those who are the victims of that person fix the situation as it was. Now, with all the greatest respect, well, not the greatest respect to Stephen Colbert, you know, monologues against the president, which insult the president, don't bring about that, right? So, meaning when you're upping your viewership in order to be able to publicly talk about somebody in office, it's not for this. Just, you know what I'm saying? There was clearly lacking the fifth condition, that is Mekaven Eto'eles. Okay? The person is not listening to what's being said over here. So just to be clear about this, it's very rare to get a situation where the public arena can be used for this with all these conditions. Just to be 100% fair, and certainly in the political arena. Let's go to stage two. And I apologize, we're going, let's just move a little bit. I want to move out of the sources just for the next section, just to carry for the sake of time. There's another reason why a person may be allowed in the public sphere to talk about an individual negatively. This is the first section was rebuking that individual, fixing the situation. Number two is, what happens if there's a predator and you need to make the public aware of that person? You need to save people from that individual. That's different to rebuking. Rebuking is what happened. The question is, what about if it's going to now create a problem? Listen to the way the Pasuk actually describes one of the prohibitions of Lashon Hara in Source 10. Lo yisalech rochel ba'amecho, lo yisamod al damreyecho. God says, don't talebear, but it's almost as in parentheses, don't stand by on the blood of your brother. Which means, that's the way the Sefer Chassidim understands it, the Sefer Charedim understands it, if your silence is going to be at the cost of somebody else's blood, then of course, let's say Telech Rachel. Of course, tell them what's going to happen because you have the right or the responsibility to talk about it so that they don't get into that situation. The Rambam, expanding on the Gemara, the Halacha says that the word al-dam doesn't only mean blood, it also means domim, which means his money. Which means to say, let's say that somebody else stands to lose money because you are silent and you knew about something and you could have warned them, you have a responsibility, you bear responsibility, that person suffered because you didn't say anything. So the question is how far can you go with this? To what degree are you allowed to do this? Now, in the legal sense, you could get sued for defamation by just opening your mouth. But the question is, in a halachic sense over here, how far are you allowed to go? So the Chofetz Chaim over here also describes this situation. This is in Hilchos Rechilos in Source 14. And he says, Im Echad Roya, on page 9, Shechaveira Roitzeli Shtatev Be'ezadovar Im Echad. You see that your friend is looking for a business opportunity and is going to now engage in a business relationship. V'meshayer, and you assess, Shebevadi Yisabev Al Yedei Ze Inyan Ra. And you know that the business partner that he's engaging in is a person who has done terrible things to other people financially. You have to tell them. You have to make it quite clear. You need 5 conditions. Now, remember, the Chofetz Chaim, his conditions weren't sucked out of his thumb. The Chofetz Chaim was, essentially, what he did was, he took the sum total of all rabbinic literature which talked on the topic, and from across the board, and turned them into a list. Which is remarkable, because up till now, you'd have to go to Rabbeinu Yonah over here, and obviously Rabbi Nosson over there, and a little bit of a section in Shari Tshuva over there, and try to work out how it all works together. The Chofetz Chaim synthesizes them into one straight and simple list. So he has his 5 conditions. Are you allowed to talk about people who are damaged or the predators of society? Yes, he says, under 5 conditions. Number 1, you have to make sure that you know it was a negative thing. It wasn't just happenstance. Number 2, you don't overstate it. You don't go beyond the pale. Number 3, and number 3 again, you should make sure that it is for the benefit. Now, there's a whole long section there on the top of the next page. 4, if you can arrange the business does not happen in another way, make sure you do that without having to disclose this individual. And as long as it's not going to be creating negativity to the person at stake, you're taking away profit rather than you're actually hurting. Now, it happens to be The Chofetz Chaim does talk about people who have gone so far that they've lost the term Re'echa, or Ba'amecha. There are people who are so bad that they're no longer a purview to Lashon Hara Bechlal, because they're so bad. So that's not what we're talking about over here. We're talking about somebody who is a former predator, but he's still somewhat within the fold. Nonetheless, over here, this is the level that a person needs to go to protect others. So is one allowed to use the public forum to protect others? The answer is yes, under these conditions, to make sure that one's not overdoing it. This becomes very difficult. Just, Chofetz Chaim goes on to describe how sure do you have to be, meaning how clear is the threat that needs to be, or you need to be aware of. We're not going to do that now because there's a little bit too little time that we're dealing with. But how sure do you have to be when you see something that it's really a threat? How big the threat is it? What are the percentages? And the Chofetz Chaim talks about this. We're not going to go into this. Basically, what I wanted to do is, in this section over here, is just to appreciate, number one, is that when there's values at tension, so one value is not to proliferate negative ideas about other people on the one side, and on the other pole you have, let's say, the notion of reprimanding people. And on the other hand, let's say you have protecting others. Where do you draw the line? So Chofetz Chaim says there's a broad spectrum, but there is allowance under certain conditions to be able to use the public forum to either reprimand people or to protect people. Those are two examples. And these are very important examples. The question is should one be doing this when it comes to politics?
What?
Politics. That's the question over here. Now we're coming to just end with this, and we're going to close with this section. I apologize, we're a little over time. Anybody needs to leave with the greatest of pleasure, or not pleasure, but we just want to just finish up in the next 10 minutes just to appreciate this point over here. These are very important. These are both very important halachic, we'll call it parameters, which are the Chofetz Chaim has set up, and these are just the framework. There's a lot more, as you can see. We just sort of touched the tip of the iceberg when it comes to these halachas. Nonetheless, the question is that the role of the pastor, priest, imam, rabbi? Is that their role to be talking politically about a particular candidate? So you believe in your heart of hearts that somebody is a really bad person, somebody is a really good person. Should you now, as your responsibility as a rabbinic leader or a religious leader or person of the cloth, should you be using the pulpit, if allowed to influence us or not?
Is it quite the guy in the
paper? Oh, it's a great question. It's a very good question. No. Moshe's question was, does Hoicher Tochich apply to non-Jews or not? So I'm moving away from the halachic model into, we'll call it, the conceptual model, which let's say we can work out a heter. I'm asking the question is should such a person be using it in the pulpit for a political statement or not, for political endorsement or removal of endorsement of particular characters? By the way, in this election cycle, it became very contentious. There were people who did, not on the pulpit, but through articles. Very complicated issues. Should you? How much does your conscience allow you or push you to say things about other people? Very complicated issues. So just as an introduction, I heard from Rav Osher Weiss the most fascinating story a little while back. Rav Osher Weiss said that, and I don't know if the story occurred, but if it didn't, it should have. Is the story that there were three of the greats of Israel who met in an inn, Huzmun Lepundak Echad, and they were Rav Yechiel Michel Epstein, who is the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, the complete work on all of Shulchan Aruch, and Rav Yechiel Michel Epstein, the Rav Chaim of Brisk, the Rav of the city of Brisk, one of the great Jewish cities in Europe, and Rav Yitzhak Yaakov Rabinovitz, Rav Itzel Aponovich, the person, one of the greats in terms of Lomdus and Torah and Torah proliferation in the last generation, all lived at the same time, and they came to the they arrived in a Rav Yitzhak Yaakov Rabinovitz. He arrived at an inn, and the question that arose at the table is, what is the role of a Rav? So they say that Rav Itzel Aponovich said, the role of a Rav is to teach Torah. Speaking after what he did, he was a great Lamdan. The role of a Rav is to teach Torah. And the Aruch HaShulchan says that the role of a Rav is to be a poizek. People ask shaylas, you need to be able to answer shaylas. Rav Chaim Briska said, the role of a Rav is to be a father and sometimes a mother to people who are in distress. And that's their conversation. That's what and each of them were speaking from the heart. Rav Chaim Briska, they say, when there was a fire in Brisk, didn't sleep in his bed until the buildings were rebuilt for the people in the community. A person who really lived on his tombstone, his original tombstone, he didn't want anything about his great chidushim and his yeshivas and his derach halimud and all the things. He wanted to just say that he was the rabbi of the Brisk, that he was a person who cared about the community. That's all he wanted. These are the three perspectives. Rav Asher Weiss's response to the story was, says, Safek d'oraisa, l'chumra. A rabbi has to be all three. Now, you know, my addition to the story is that if a rabbi in the 2017 had been at that inn with him, had the schus of being in that interaction, he would have mentioned a few other parts of the job description where it comes to program development and fundraising and office management and head of the welcome committee and CEO and all the different other aspects which have now become part of the rabbinic role. And all of them are very important and should be fitted into the 24 hours of the limited day. But nonetheless, all very important things. But the question is in that rubric, is having a political public opinion one of them? So the question is politics part of the conversation? And the answer at the beginning is absolutely, in the sense that most political issues are religious issues. Immigration talks about certain basic religious principles. When you talk about, let's say, well, you know, we'll call it contraception, family planning. These are religious issues. These are issues where the Torah has a say in them. When it comes to gender issues, when it comes to education issues, these, a lot of the political issues are things which are fundamentally religious. And therefore, communal leaders should have a say in them or should have a perspective of what is correct. No question. The question is not so much the issues, but the people. Can you use the pulpit to talk about endorsing a particular person or not? And the answer is unequivocally no. It is not the role of a rabbi or a leader to talk about particular political leaders or to endorse or not in a certain cycle. Why not? Very, very simple. Why not?
It's irrelevant.
Okay, so number one is maybe there's no toelis. But more than that, maybe there is a negativity. Who do we know? Meaning, who here is a prophet to know what's going to be the end of the day? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, the sage, the conduit of Torah Shebaal Peh, did endorse a political candidate. Who did he endorse? Bar Kokhba. It says, in fact, the Gemara in Yerushalmi over here, take a look at the end. Rabbi Akiva was endorsed Bar Kokhba. Take a look on the bottom of page 11. This is the Gemara in Yerushalmi. Talmud Yerushalmi in Tainus says, Tani Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Akiva, Rabbi Yoyodoresh, Dorach Koichov Miyakov, Dorach Kuzba Miyakov. He looked at the Pasuk in Parshas Balak and he said, when it says Dorach Koichov Miyakov, he drew a star from Yaakov, from Jacob, he was talking about Bar Kochba. That's the Messiah, is Bar Kochba. And you know what they responded to Rabbi Akiva? They said, Rabbi Akiva, Kadhavam Chami Bar Kuzba, who are Havo Omar, Dinhu Malko Mashiach, you'd say that he was the Melech Mashiach. Omale Rabbi Yochanan Ben Turta, Akiva, Yalu Asomim Bel Chayayich, Vadain Ben David Loi Yovoi. There'll be grass growing through you. Rabbi Akiva, you will be dead before Mashiach comes. You made a mistake, and in fact, history proved them right as opposed to Rabbi Akiva. It's dangerous. It's dangerous to. We don't know what the outcome is. Historically, I saw that Rabbi Korobkin from the Bayit made a very interesting point. Take a look at the next page. It's a little faded on the last page over here. 1812. Napoleon is sweeping across Europe. France is now on the upswing after a bloody revolution, reconstitution of the Republic. Now Napoleon Bonaparte is sweeping across Europe. Do you support him? He makes his incursion into Russia against Tsar Alexander I. Who do you support? Who do you support? Happens to be at the time, Ashneel Zaman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe said, you support the Tsar. You support the Tsar. It's much safer to be under the reign of a Tsar than to be under the open ghettos of Napoleon. Whereas the personage of Rav Levius or Berdichev was on the other side. Liberation for the Jews. Can we definitively say who was better today? 200 years later, can we definitively say who was actually better for the Jews? We look how many people were killed under the Tsar. Look how many people assimilated under Napoleon's rule. It's not so clear. You have to be very, very careful when it comes to endorsing particular people. In fact, when it comes to, we talked about this a little while back, the Tefillah L'Shlom HaMedina. When it comes to the Tefillah L'Shlom HaMedina, you'll see people over here today going backwards and forwards and yes and no. The halacha is you always say Shlom, Tefillah L'Shlom HaMedina. It doesn't make a difference which candidate it is, which nominee, which elect. who it is, which president it is. You always say Tzvila Shalom Medina, and the Mefarshim say is because woe to you if you think you can predict the future. Woe to you if you think you're going to pin all your hopes on one person, and then you put all those eggs in that basket, and the basket flips. Folks, the system is bipartisan; it moves all the time. Our role is not to be explicitly talking and using the pulpit for that particular ends and goal. In the end of that, there's many roles that of the rabbinate. But one of them is not putting oneself in this. And perhaps the last thing, and with this I'll close, perhaps even more dangerous than all of this, is the fact that in a good political system like we are blessed with here, and I say that with the greatest of meaning, because coming from a system where it is less transparent and less clear, and there's so much corruption in other democratic systems, and you come to America and there's such a beautiful system, there's many difficulties in the system. That means to say that in a regular Jewish community, you're going to have people who have different places on the political spectrum. Is it the Rav's responsibility? Is it the priest's? Is it the Imam's responsibility to isolate some of the people in the community because of a political view? The greatest threat is that when a person comes up and endorses a particular candidate, is that all the other roles of leadership, of caring, of the religious values are lost because you've estranged perhaps half, perhaps a third, perhaps a quarter, perhaps even an eighth of the community because of political opinions. And that undermines all the other job descriptions of what a religious leader is supposed to be. So with the greatest respect, coming full circle over here, it is a wonderful thing. And again, we're going to see how it plays out politically, legally, what's going to happen with the executive order this last Thursday. But I think for us, as religious Jews, it's an opportunity to say to ourselves, how free are we to speak? That's number one. How free are we to speak? Number one, that's option number one. Number two is what is the goal of the soapbox of the pulpit? What is the goal of leadership? What is our goal in society? And that's the questions that should be raising for us. I hope this is an introduction into that very fascinating topic. Thank you. רחנים לקשר מורה צעק קדוש ברוך הוא לזעקוס ישראל לפי חלקי בו להם צורם ישראל שנאמר אנחנו עובד זמן ציקו ידיל תורה ויעדיר.